Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last year, the Federal Communications Commission voted to repeal net neutrality rules adopted 2 years ago under the Obama administration. Net neutrality ensures a level playing field for internet service providers and their customers. That means you. Without net neutrality rules in place, providers can charge more and slower block websites and apps. But last week, the Senate approved a resolution to undo the FCC's decision. The resolution comes less than a month before the rules are set to expire. Washington Post policy reporter Brian Fung has been covering the latest on the state of net neutrality. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First, give us some context here. We know it maintains a level playing field, but what do we mean by net neutrality? What's the bottom line there?
Yeah, so net neutrality is an idea about fairness on the internet. It basically holds that internet providers shouldn't be allowed to block or slow down websites. Certain aspects of it say that internet providers shouldn't even be allowed to speed up websites in exchange for extra payments from the website owners. All of this is aimed at essentially making sure that small businesses and startups can compete and survive against large businesses that would otherwise be able to afford some of these payments.
The FCC said under the Trump administration, in repealing these or undoing these net neutrality rules, that net neutrality stagnates industry. It prevents it from investing. It de-incentivizes the industry from investing in its networks. Why is that? Don't they make enough money?
Yeah, so the argument that the FCC is putting forward here is that these rules are extremely restrictive and they're costly to comply with, requiring companies to, make disclosures to the government or get tied up in lots of lengthy, adjudicatory fights about, whether or not net neutrality has actually been violated. And so the argument by ISPs and backed by the FCC has been that these rules, which are expected to go off the books on June 11th, mm-hmm. Are actually going to hinder companies as they try to invest in upgrading their networks to be better, faster, and more reliable.
Why is that? I mean, just because the cost, it would come out of research and development?
Yeah, the argument is that the compliance cost would be rather high for these companies, the thought that the FCC is putting forward is that by undoing some of these regulations, they can incentivize companies like AT&T and Verizon to pour more money into their networks.
So, has anything happened to suggest that's the case since the FCC voted to end net neutrality?
Well, it's important to remember here that the net neutrality rules are still on the books, and they actually won't go off the books until June 11th. Even though the FCC voted last year to repeal the rules, it took some time for that decision to work its way through the federal bureaucracy.
Hmm. And even if at this point the FCC could change its mind, ultimately, how do the service providers, the internet service providers, ever have a guarantee enough to make them more freewheeling with their money?
Yeah, that's right. So we've seen this issue kind of seesaw back and forth with the rules first being proposed and passed in 2015, and then in 2017, the FCC changing its mind under Republican leadership, saying that these rules are no longer necessary. And one could imagine that if there is another Democratic administration in the future, the FCC under Democratic control might then decide, let's reinstate these rules. So a lot of folks in Washington are really focused on how to settle this debate once and for all. Mostly Democrats believe that it'll be litigation that settles this. Others seem to think congressional legislation addressing this once and for all could be the solution here. But legislatively, anything on net neutrality is going to be a heavy lift given how sensitive this issue is politically.
So I was surprised it got through the Senate. It felt kind of relatively easily.
Well, what was interesting about the Senate vote was how many Republicans voted for the resolution.
Right.
On the day of the vote, even hours before, most people who were watching were expecting one or two Republicans to side with the Democrats on this, but in fact, they actually got three. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but
in a split Senate, it is. Yeah,
that's right. And so, this resolution now will go to the House, and if it does get picked up there. Then it'll be interesting as far as how it could play out. But most people think that the House leadership will not actually bring this to a floor vote, and it will take a discharge petition, essentially a lawmakers who support the resolution trying to force a floor vote and go around the House leadership on this.
In this case, do they have to go the resolution route because it would repeal something a federal agency has done?
Yeah, so the resolution is being put forward under what's known as the Congressional Review Act, and that's a law that allows Congress to take another look at administrative decisions and then to reverse them if they find that those decisions didn't comport with what Congress laid out for those agencies in their charter of powers, essentially.
And the House, even still, I mean, obviously they probably got started in the Senate because it was going to have a warmer reception. The House is less likely, whether it ever reaches the floor or not, is less likely to vote for something like this.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a big unknown right now. You have Democrats who are emboldened by the Senate vote saying mm-hmm. This shows, how much appeal there is for this resolution, and it kind of highlights how they're going to put pressure on House lawmakers in, various districts, asking constituents to call in and whatnot to try and bring those lawmakers to the table. But that said, there are a lot more of them in the House, obviously, and so it's going to be a much bigger lift.
The internet service providers, are they just lobbying the stuffing out of Congress right now about this?
Well, they've been lobbying all year, and in past years too, they're one of the among the top contributors to Congress every year. So this year is no different. And for them, this is kind of a game-changing kind of policy debate because a lot of them are trying to shift business models where it's no longer just enough to provide internet service. Many of them, such as AT&T and Verizon, have bought up a lot of online content companies in a way to in a bid to try and develop online advertising businesses that can compete with the likes of Google and Facebook. And for them, this is about trying to expand their business model and survive in a digital world.
How has the Trump administration, the head of the FCC, how have they responded to what happened in the Senate?
The opponents of the resolution have largely said this is a political stunt that doesn't really have a chance of going anywhere, and they say that ultimately they believe that lasting changes can only come from a legislative solution, and whether or not that'll actually occur is an open question right now.
A legislative solution, isn't that what they're shooting for here with the resolution?
So when the resolution is narrowly targeted at overturning the FCC's decision that would then restore the FCC's net neutrality rules, what opponents of the resolution say would be the real legislative solution would be for Democrats and Republicans to come together to iron out what congressional rules for net neutrality, rather than having net neutrality be enshrined by agency rules and regulations at that level.
Mm. Now, what is the expectation about what happens next?
Well, we're kind of waiting to see what happens in the House. If they do manage to pass the resolution, then it goes to the president's desk. But even then, President Trump isn't expected to sign the resolution, given that the White House is already supportive of the FCC's vote to repeal the net neutrality rules. Meanwhile, there are a number of lawsuits moving forward on net neutrality, so we may see some action there in the next year or two.
Well, all right. So if the president doesn't sign it, can it become law anyways?
In theory, if you had a congressional enough votes to override the president's veto, but
that's unlikely.
That seems unlikely at this point, given how the numbers are essentially stacked. But a lot of Democrats say this is about the election and trying to force vulnerable Republicans to go on the record saying that they don't support the FCC's rules. And these rules, according to Democrats, is very highly supported by both Republicans and Democratic voters.
The rules are set to expire on June 11th. If there are lawsuits brought, if this is in flux at the federal and at the congressional level, what does that mean? I mean, will the lawsuits put a stay on this?
The lawsuits will probably move forward independently of whatever happens in Congress. You have, an appeal essentially by supporters of the net neutrality rules, trying to take this issue to the D.C. Circuit. And at the same time, you have another issue, another case that the Supreme Court is weighing whether or not to hear that in its upcoming session. We should be getting a decision on that probably sometime this fall.
Is there, when they announce what their schedule is going to be for next year, is there a sense about where the Supreme Court might stand on something like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most legal experts would probably, defer to the justices on this. It's generally not wise to try and predict what the court might try to do. But what's interesting here is that Justice Gorsuch has been a very outspoken critic of something called the Chevron deference, which is a legal doctrine that says generally courts should defer to expert agencies on whatever decisions they make. Mm. And in this case, the Chevron deference happened to work in the FCC's favor when supporters of the net neutrality rules were defending the rules from ISPs in 2016. Now, that same doctrine might end up helping the FCC keep its repeal on the books.
Wow. Brian Fung, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
Brian Fung is a Washington Post policy reporter. He's been covering the issue of net neutrality. It's set to expire by way of the FCC on June 11th. The Senate has passed a resolution upholding the net neutrality rules. Whether or not it makes its way through the House is debatable, but there will be lawsuits. We probably will talk again, Brian. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, a hacker broke into the servers of Securus, a company that buys phone location data for major telecom companies and sells it to law enforcement. The news comes on the heels of a New York Times report published in early May, which detailed how law enforcement have access to a system that can locate nearly any phone in the country. Contributing writer for Motherboard, Joseph Cox, has been covering the story. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First, tell us about the original New York Times report that was published earlier in the month. What did they find?
Sure. So the New York Times found that this company, as you say, called Securus, is buying geolocation data from, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, all of the major telcos. And typically that data is sold for marketing purposes, but Securus, in a rather novel way, and bought it and then offered this service to law enforcement, or more specifically jails and prisons, so they can track, where inmates are calling in case maybe they're calling a dealer or someone to break them out or whatever it may be. But there's very little legal oversight and technical oversight on how that tool is used. So the New York Times found that at least one officer was actually abusing the service to spy on a judge, I think, and other law enforcement officials as well.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Sorry. My guest is Joseph Cox. He's a contributing writer for Motherboard. He has been covering the story of Securus. That's a company that buys phone location data from major telecom companies and sells it to law enforcement. Last week, a hacker broke into the servers of Securus, creating a little bit of a problem. He just explained the New York Times report published earlier in May that detailed how law enforcement have access to a system that can locate nearly any phone in the country. So say you can hack into that. That's not good for the rest of us. You're listening once again to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Joseph Cox, you back there with me?
Hey, yeah, I'm back.
Great. All right, so tell us about Securus. What kind of company is it?
It's a relatively unknown company. Me included, didn't even know about it until the New York Times exposed it. But it seems to sit in this bizarre space where it seems to be taking advantage of a lot of data from telcos that nobody's really looked into. I mean, we look into stingrays, IMSI catchers, and all this very technical surveillance equipment that law enforcement may use. But then, largely in the shadows, telcos have been providing a hell of a lot of data to other companies who are abusing it and then providing it to law enforcement with minimal oversight as well.
Are there a lot of other companies like this?
It seems there are quite a few. I'm sure more are going to be discovered now. But another cybersecurity journalist, Brian Krebs, he found that a different company called Location Smart, where you could just go onto their website and there was a sort of demo and it said, hey, you can track anybody in the U.S. with using our service. Here's a demo and then you can sign up and pay for it. The thing was that the website had a vulnerability in it, meaning it was very easy for anybody visiting the website to look up the details on any phone in the U.S. So not only are there apparently more companies in this space, they seemingly don't really take cybersecurity that seriously either, which is incredibly concerning when they have access to such sensitive data on such a large volume of people.
How did a hacker break into Securus's servers? It just was that vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, so I can't really talk specifically about how the hacker broke in because I'm not sure if Securus has actually fixed the issue.
Oh, okay.
And of course, if I got too specific, it would probably help other people. But I will say that the way they described it to me, it was really, really simple, like quite scarily simple in how they broke in. And again, it's just an indication of how seriously, or lack thereof, that these companies are actually handling this data. If a hacker could break in a matter of minutes.
When we talk about law enforcement using this data, what kind of law enforcement? All the way up the food chain or locals a lot? I mean, what do we mean by this?
So Securus markets the product to prisons and jails. So, you know, deputy wardens, that sort of thing. But in the New York Times piece, they found that a local sheriff was the one abusing it. I think when it gets to stuff like the FBI and maybe federal law enforcement, they don't necessarily need to use tools like this because they're probably going to have access to more data from the telcos anyway, obviously depending on the sort of case or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. But the real concern here is that when you have this sensitive data, and the access to that data trickles down to the more local law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Of course, then you have more people who can access it and potentially abuse it as well. So it's the trickle down or the proliferation of this capability that's probably more worrying than it being accessible to federal law enforcement.
Why does this fall through the cracks when it comes to warrants? Don't they need warrants before they get that kind of information?
So the courts are really torn on whether you need a warrant for location data. Of course, for text messages or the actual content of messages, that's going to be something else. But to just find out where a phone is located at any one time, some say you do. Other courts say you only need it if it's in real time, and others don't worry about a warrant at all. I couldn't tell you the specific states, but there is definitely disagreement around this. And that's probably why these companies have been able to act with such impunity as well, because there is such ambiguity in the law around this data.
This comes after the Facebook Cambridge Analytica saga. Why What is the deal with the security on these companies on the internet?
Yeah, there is definitely a cultural shift, and maybe we're just getting a lot more aware of it now. Of not only, oh, do we give data to AT&T or Facebook or whoever it may be, and we typically think about that. Now, as a public, we're realizing, hey, who else has access to that data? Who else can easily get my phone records or get my likes on Facebook or whatever it may be? I don't know why this is only just coming out now, but it's long overdue. And hopefully there can be more scrutiny and more reporting around these companies and others as well. I mean, it's not just going to be telcos and Facebook. Mm-hmm. It may be a Google Android phone and the sort of data that's collecting, or a lot of the apps that seem innocuous that you install on your phone, but a hell of a lot of those also take GPS data as well. And that data is going somewhere and someone is using it for a purpose.
Democratic Senator from Oregon, Rick Wyden, sent a letter to the big telecom companies and the FCC. What was he talking to them about regarding this?
So Wyden's letter to the telcos such as AT&T and Sprint was basically, hey, can you tell me who are you sharing data with? Can you stop any inappropriate transfers? And how many organizations have access to this data? And I mean, the telcos have given several statements over the past couple of weeks saying, oh, we're going to stop this, we weren't aware, and this goes against our policies or whatever it may be. But that's only now, and this stuff has been going on for years. And Wyden also asked the FCC to investigate, which will be interesting because, of course, the head of the FCC actually was a lawyer, I believe, for Securus. So there is a massive conflict of interest going on there.
Pi was it lawyer
so now,
for, okay.
Right. So now Wyden is asking the head of the FCC to recuse himself from that investigation. It's kind of unclear whether that's actually going to happen at the moment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's going to get messy. But hopefully some more information will come out of it as well.
And what's the reception been by the FCC?
I believe they say that they will look into it, but I don't think an official investigation has been launched yet, as far as I know. Maybe my information may be a day or two out of date, but as far as I know, they haven't jumped into it yet. But hopefully they'll be doing that soon.
And I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about Securus haven't necessarily fixed the problem yet.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think how to phrase it, because, of course, it is very sensitive. I don't want to point hackers to the right place.
Right.
But, I haven't had an indication yet that they fixed the problem. I mean, when I work with a data breach victim, I will provide them snippets of data so they have enough context to provide a statement. Mm-hmm. It's not my job as a journalist to fix their infrastructure, though.
No.
So,
right.
Although they're aware of the issue, I haven't seen that they've actually fixed it yet. But they really should get on that if they haven't done it already.
Exactly. What is the protocol for stuff like that? What do you understand about what the protocol is when a firm like Securus has been hacked? Are there any laws in place to say you got to fix this or you got to shut down?
No, I mean, in the U.S., data breach laws are terrible. Some places will have a data breach notification statute, or like you have to warn the victims or whatever it may be.
Uh-huh.
But in the majority of places, there isn't really legislation or regulation to deal with that sort of thing. I mean, we saw that recently with the Uber case where they were hacked and something like 50 million account details were taken. Uber sat on that information for months at a time and only really came out about it later. So if this hacker hadn't have come to a journalist, it's pretty unlikely we would have actually heard about the breach until the data ended up, being sold among hackers or something like that. Fortunately, at least from appearances, the source who provided the data to me isn't selling it, as far as I know. So it should be relatively contained. But yeah, in other cases, companies will just sit on it for as long as they can.
And in other countries, how do they regulate it?
I mean, in the UK, you have the Information Commissioner's Officer, and they will fine organizations or companies if there is a data breach. I mean, just yesterday or the day before, a university was fined something like £120,000 for a data breach. So if the ICO finds out, they will try to act in their role as a law enforcement body, although people do criticize the agency for not really having that much power or really going after, but they do some work as well. So elsewhere in the world, it can be better. But yeah, US is notorious for having quite awful data breach regulations and laws and notifications.
Why is that? I mean, why are we so far behind?
I mean, it may be, and of course this is more speculating, but maybe it's the Silicon Valley mindset of move fast, break things, worry about it later. Maybe it's about a lack of cybersecurity understanding on the Hill in general. But you brought up Facebook, and we're only just realizing that now. And as I said, with this sort of cultural shift of public realization, maybe that can actually change, because people do care about what actually happens to their data. I mean, a lot of people have deleted Facebook. Their stock price may not have been that affected, but they're constantly in the news now. So maybe, and especially in Europe with the GDPR, the new data protection legislation, maybe the U.S. can see something similar later, but it's not going to happen soon.
You know, I can go off Facebook if I want, but I can't do anything about a company like Securus that can tell people where my phone is.
Right, right. And that's a real problem that some researchers have been pointing out. As you say, you can, I don't want to use Twitter, or I don't want to use Facebook. Well, AT&T and Sprint, Verizon are constantly collecting data on where your phone is, because in virtue of that is how the phone network works. They need to know where your phone is located so they can route calls to it. And they can, I'm next to this cell tower and that cell tower, so the text message arrives. It's intrinsic to the actual system.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to avoid that, you don't use a phone, which is not an ideal situation for most people, I appreciate. So, yeah, it's even harder than the Facebook issue, definitely.
Has there been any public, I haven't heard any public outcry over this.
No, it has been pretty quiet. We keep bringing up Facebook and everyone is talking about that. And then in the information security world, there may be another issue or vulnerability that people will chat about. But when it comes to telcos, there's sort of a collective shrug, at least in like the communities I speak to, security researchers and hackers and that sort of thing. And if those guys aren't concerned, then I don't think the public are going to hear about it. You know what I mean?
So, yeah. Well, in your reporting, is there a sense that the public is kind of exhausted by all of this?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely, at least when it comes to data breaches, more specifically, I mean, there's always data breach fatigue. Like, this thing got hacked, and it was 10 million accounts and 100 million accounts, or whatever. And I guess the public may just be, exhausted by all of this, which is the bad response. We should be telling people how to be more secure and how to actually lock down their digital lives. But it can get really, really tiring. And the same likely does apply to, your phone can be tracked wherever. Well, what are they going to do about it? It must be quite paralyzing as a member of the public who doesn't really know how to deal with it. And maybe as journalists and researchers, we should try to communicate that risk a little bit better so people can make decisions about what they want to do around it.
Well, get on it, Joseph. Joseph Cox, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Joe Cox, he's contributing writer for Motherboard. We'll have a link to his article about how the hacker broke into the servers of Securus. That's a company that buys phone location data from major telecom companies and sells it to law enforcement. So stay with us. We have more Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's being called the phone that delivers in almost every way. Android's latest version of the OnePlus, the OnePlus 6, looks great. It's affordable as smartphones come. But one improved feature is making all the difference. Joining us by phone to talk about that and more tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome as always, Russell.
Thanks.
OnePlus 6. First, tell us about the OnePlus series of smartphones that Android has been releasing.
Sure. So OnePlus is kind of a weird company. They showed up almost out of nowhere, promising a phone that was going to, you know, destroy all of the high end competition. Instead of spending, you know, what at the time was $700 for the most expensive phone that you could buy, you'd be able to get this phone for $300, and it would offer all of the major features that you could get from these big names like Samsung and Apple, and didn't quite deliver. You know, their big promise, you know, it wasn't a super great camera, and they ran into some other problems with manufacturing, and it was only available on one or two of the carriers. But it was a really ambitious thing, and $300 for a phone at that time that was as good as it was still a very good proposition compared to the $700 and $800 that you would pay for an iPhone or a Samsung phone. And this has continued over the last couple of years to kind of chase these larger brands with instead of very flashy advertising, it's been very online focused marketing that OnePlus has deployed in order to attract this very kind of niche following of people who absolutely love this hardware and see it very much as an escape from these bigger names.
Tell us about the OnePlus 6. What sets it apart?
The OnePlus 6 is a phone that really has a profile that looks very, very similar to an iPhone 10, as far as the bezels that are cut from all around it. It even has the funny little notch up at the top that the iPhone 10 has because there's so much space focused on the display, with a very nice camera on the back. And it has a feature that's unique to Android. There aren't very many Android phones that offer this particular feature, but it's common on an iPhone, which is the alert slider. It's a little shutter button that turns off. You just flick the switch and it turns off all of your notification sounds and your ringtones and everything as kind of a mute button that just doesn't really exist on Android phones. And it's always been on OnePlus phones, which has been a very cool feature. But best of all, it's a phone that legitimately competes with Apple and Samsung, these kind of $1,000 phones that exist now, and this phone starts at $529.
It sounds like they're copying iPhone in some ways. And wasn't there a big stink about the shape of the curve of a phone, and Apple was trying to fight another company for copying them?
So this was Samsung. Apple and Samsung were fighting back and forth, and it was actually this is going to sound even more silly than it actually was. The lawsuit was actually the biggest piece of evidence in the lawsuit was actually the curve of the icons on the screen.
Okay.
So the icons, Apple was able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Samsung had designed their icons to look very similar to Apple's icons in the early versions of its phone.
So what's the difference? I mean, why isn't Apple going after OnePlus for copying?
So some of these things are hardware decisions that can't be, it can't be tied specifically to Apple. You know, the big notch cutout thing on the front, it didn't actually start with Apple.
Okay.
There was a company called Essential that had done it first. And now there are so many other companies that are using this as a method of making their phones feel taller that it's going to be an industry standard, basically, by this time next year. And if you look at the back of the phone, they are very, very different. You know, OnePlus it keeps its fingerprint sensor on the back, and it has a dual camera setup that is in the center of the phone instead of up in the top corner. And, the visuals that are put into this phone as far as the glass back is, designed to be this kind of high gloss setup is very different from the way that an iPhone looks. So it does have some similarities on the front side of it. But they're definitely very different phones when you go to hold it and feel it. It does not feel like this phone was made to copy Apple.
Okay. And the camera, you said it wasn't a very great camera. Is that something that was improved on OnePlus 6?
This has been improved on pretty dramatically with the OnePlus 6. The camera operates very good in low light. It has, a secondary sensor that's great for a lot of different, kind of functionality with taking pictures in just a bunch of different situations. This is something that OnePlus has wanted for a really long time, is to have a camera that had, optical image stabilization and was able to kind of capture more light. And then unfortunately, when you're a smaller company, getting those parts can be very expensive. And so this is what it's done. And instead of doing kind of the Apple approach to having the secondary camera on the bottom that zooms in, this secondary sensor is actually, it's a 20 megapixel sensor, and it's actually designed to offer more depth information
to the front camera, to the first camera, so that you can do things like the portrait mode shot, where it looks like it was taken with a professional camera and things like that.
How big of a deal is a great camera these days?
It really just depends on what kind of phone user you are. You know, I think a lot of people look at their phone as kind of their default camera now when they go on vacation. It's a lot less work than carrying around a traditional photo camera. You know, there are lots of people who, you know, fancy themselves photographers who don't think much about the camera on their phone. But I think, speaking for myself, you know, having the camera on my phone that I can take pictures in any situation is really only reason that I don't bring a normal camera with me places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it has OnePlus 6 stayed in the price point? Is it stayed in the same price point?
No. This is, you know, I guess the argument there could be made that OnePlus has increased at the same rate that Samsung and Apple have increased, you know, mm-hmm. so that they started out as a $299 phone for the original OnePlus One. This phone starts at $529, but the things that they're competing with, you know, the phones that are being competed with here, the Galaxy S8 and the iPhone X, have models that climb up to $1,000. So, you know, if you're looking at those as options and you want something that's significantly cheaper without really sacrificing a ton in the way of features, OnePlus really wants you to know that they exist. And the reason that I put it that way is that this is still a phone that, isn't sold in carrier stores. You're not going to be able to walk into a T-Mobile and find it. These are sold initially just through OnePlus, and then they'll eventually be sold through Amazon. And they also don't work on every carrier in the U.S. They currently work. They're designed for AT&T and T-Mobile. They don't really have Verizon certification, and they don't have Sprint certification either. That's not to say that they won't at some point in the future, but the hardware is still not quite as globally designed as we would see with something from another manufacturer.
So when you say they really want people to know, how are they getting the word out when they're on, well, I guess online, right?
Yeah, their online strategy has been pretty successful for, reaching out to nerds like me. but it's not, it hasn't been super successful for reaching people who are just kind of looking for a new phone. And so that's been the big challenge this year is to try and reach as many new people as possible. And it's not yet clear how successful their current strategy is, but they're definitely appealing to people who know a lot about phones and just want something that's a little different from I guess the phone everyone else has.
Is it still the case that most people get their phones through service providers?
Absolutely. Yeah, especially here in the U.S.
And do you think that's going to stay that way forever, or do you think it's going to change?
I think it's going to stay that way here in the U.S. for a long time. We got rid of the concept of contracts and subsidizing through contracts, but we really just kind of replaced that with a different subsidy method. When you walk into a store, you pay, you know, kind of a separate monthly fee for the phone that you want. And I think a lot of people still go that route for buying a phone. So you're not spending $1,000 up front. You're spending, you know, $30 a month for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a different setup, but not entirely, you know, the way that everyone buys phones. We've definitely seen more and more people over the last couple of years decide that they would rather buy their phone outright so that they have the opportunity to move from T-Mobile to Verizon to Sprint, or other carriers without having to worry about any of the things that would kind of pull and keep you on one contract.
You wanted to talk about YouTube Music and the YouTube Premium. YouTube Red is being replaced by YouTube Music and YouTube Premium. Why?
Yeah, so this is really weird. This is kind of fascinating. There has always been a group of people who have used YouTube as a music streaming service, like Spotify or Pandora. They've used YouTube, and the way that they have done that is creating a playlist of songs that are basically music videos. But instead of looking at the screen, the screen is off, and it's just a playlist that's playing on their phone. And it has always been a feature, you know, either on a desktop or on phones. And YouTube has never really figured out how to make money off of this, which is something that they really wanted to do. They started their own music playing service, thinking that they could get people to go and just use YouTube or Google Play Music, and then they started, you know, to kind of push people in that general direction by making, ad-free systems that you could go through with YouTube Red, where you pay a subscription and you just don't ever have any ads on YouTube. But this entire setup, it has never stopped people from creating just massive playlists of songs that they just listen to, because it's on YouTube and you can watch an unlimited amount of things on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And so YouTube Music is an attempt to kind of separate the two kinds of people who use YouTube, the people who use YouTube just for video and the people who use it for music, so that they can offer more features to, the music group of people in the hopes of getting them to pick up a subscription.
So there's YouTube Music and YouTube Premium. What'll be the differences? No ads?
Right. YouTube Premium is basically the YouTube Red service, which means you can watch an unlimited amount of YouTube videos and never have to worry about seeing an ad on it, as well as access to a whole bunch of stuff that's made just for YouTube. So in the same way that you can watch stuff that's only made on Netflix, YouTube has a set of TV channels basically that are made by a whole bunch of different people that have shows that come out every week that you only can watch if you're watching through YouTube Premium. One of the most recent of which is Cobra Kai, which I really liked. It kind of took me back to my childhood a little bit there. But
how so? Tell me.
Well, so it's the Karate Kid. They took the Karate Kid story.
Oh, that one. Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, okay.
They brought it forward, which was really well done. They're going to do a second season that I really liked. I'm not very good at talking about television, which is why I don't do it a whole lot. But they've done that pretty well, and they've gotten people excited about YouTube Premium because shows like that are coming to YouTube Premium. But it's still not the same kind of service that you would get from YouTube Music. So the idea here is to have YouTube Music, if you are just the kind of person who wants music with no ads and you can listen in the background and download music to listen when you're not in offline mode, YouTube Music is going to exist as a separate service that you get for $10 a month. You can have that as kind of a separate thing. If you want that as well as the ad-free video and access to the YouTube original service, then you would pay an extra $2 a month to have all of the services as part of YouTube Premium for, as part of the subscription.
And this is competitive with, the other streaming services?
The music side of this competes pretty closely with Pandora and with Spotify. The difference there really is there is no YouTube Music mechanism for people who don't want to pay for the service aside from just using the normal YouTube service.
Mm-hmm.
So this is it's still a little complicated because this is still targeted initially to a group of people who already have their own system in place that they've made for listening to a ton of music without paying for it by listening and just dealing with the ads. So the big challenge here for Google is to build this service up in such a way that they are convincing people that they feel the need to pay this $10 a month for YouTube Music.
So these are I was going to say, what happens to these people now? I mean, they can just continue doing what they're doing.
The YouTube app is still going to function the way that it's supposed to, but the YouTube Music service is going to be entirely music focused. So, if you have a playlist through YouTube Music, you're not going to have to worry about, YouTube accidentally recommending something in the background that's not music. It'll all be just kind of related to music things, and it'll have a greater focus there. So there are some benefits to using the YouTube Music service over just the normal YouTube system. And that's Google's big hope there, is that by creating this separate system that's all built for that, that they can get people to subscribe and benefit from it that way.
The soft launch is today. What's that going to be like?
So you'll see, if you're an existing YouTube customer, you'll see an update to the YouTube app that will change all of the language in the app from YouTube Red to YouTube Premium. Mm-hmm. And if you are interested in YouTube Music, then you'll be taken to an option to subscribe for that. If you already pay for YouTube Red, you don't have to pay anything extra for YouTube Music or YouTube Premium. It's already part of your subscription, which for a lot of people was actually $7.99 a month instead of the $9.99 a month. So if you're an existing YouTube Red subscriber and you continue paying your monthly subscription that you're paying for now, then when this software update hits your phone, all of that stuff will just automatically work and you'll be paying the same amount that you always were.
Moving on, Hewlett-Packard's HP MV by 2 times 2? What is it?
Yeah, it's just X2.
X2. God, I'll tell you. Okay. What is it?
We don't like name things really particularly well for just about anything. Yeah, so this is actually the first of a new kind of laptop from HP, and it'll eventually be a new kind of laptop from a couple of different companies. This is what's called an always connected PC. It runs Windows 10. It's a very thin, almost iPad looking laptop with a very nice keyboard attached to it and a pen that you can draw on the screen with that runs a full version of Windows. But instead of being powered by a traditional desktop processor that we think about in a normal laptop or a desktop computer, this is actually powered by the same kind of processor that is found in high-end phones like the Samsung Galaxy S8. And that's important for two reasons. One, they use a whole lot less power than a normal desktop computer. So the idea is that, you know, these are consuming a whole lot less energy and the battery will last more than a couple of hours like you would get from a normal laptop. But as part of the always connected setup, this also has an LTE radio in it, which means you can actually pay for cellular service for your laptop and have it just always connected to the internet.
And that's just the same as having another phone hooked up on your service?
You'd end up paying a separate data line instead of for phone. You'd be paying for just data, which is a different monthly fee depending on who your carrier is. But you would end up being paying for it as though it were a separate line.
Okay, so what's the hardware like? You like it?
It's nice. It's very, very thin. It's definitely an expensive system for people who are thinking about a laptop. But the idea here is that it is a laptop for people who like the idea of an iPad but need something that just does a little bit more or has a system that functions a little bit more for kind of day-to-day work communications like email and things like that. So it's really just the next kind of wave of laptops that we're going to see with running Windows are these kind of very thin machines that you can choose to, you know, pay a cellular monthly fee for if you want to.
It's for a specific user. Tell us more about who that person is.
This is really just a very mobile person who wants all of the things that you normally get with a Windows laptop. You know, when I think about a Windows laptop, I think about something that's between 3 and 4 pounds that I kind of have to make sure is in a special bag that I bring with me and kind of have to deal with throughout the day. I have to remember that it's kind of there. These tablets, basically, they start at a pound and a half, and they work very much like you would expect an iPad to work if you're familiar with that environment as far as the weight and how it connects to the internet and things, but it runs a full version of Windows 10.
Is it you mentioned the price, but you didn't say exactly what it was.
Oh, it's $1,000. This is a $999 laptop, which, you know, for a lot of people is a very expensive laptop. But the idea here, if this is the kind of computing that you want to do where portability is the thing that matters most, then this is a really good way to go. If you want something that you know is going to be a little more capable, then you mm-hmm. probably aren't really looking for this machine just yet.
Russell Holley, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Russell Holley is a contributing writer for Android Central, contributing editor for Android Central. We are done with Tech Tuesday today. I appreciate you listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.